Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Conservation Commissioner for the State of New York and former President of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll look at hunting and religion. Deer season is just wrapping up in most parts of the country, but chances are deer populations will remain high. We'll look at deer hunting and management and the ongoing relationship between humans and the whitetail. Then we'll examine the greening of religion. The relationship between faith and ecology is getting new emphasis. We'll speak with three theologians from different religions. We'll hear what you've been saying about having a sustainable holiday. Listeners have suggested alternatives which foster the holiday spirit and protect the planet. And our Earth calendar will explore the Amazon rainforest, where rivers are rising and water lilies are so big that natives use them as playpens for their children. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. A subject which arouses emotions in almost every community is deer hunting. Hunters are passionate about the sport. Animal rights activists are passionate about the deer. Whole communities derive portions of their income from visiting sportsmen. Non-hunter outdoors people resent the fear of getting shot at in the woods during deer season. The fact is that the sport and craft of hunting deer has been passed on from generation to generation, probably for as long as humans have occupied the continent. But there is more to it than putting meat on the table. Joel DeGarmo is a deer hunter from New England who was taught to hunt by his father and who watched his own son take his first deer last month. He explains that the hunt is an experience with special meaning.
You really have the time to really notice a lot of things out in the woods, and that's what's so special to me, is just getting out there and looking at these things and looking at those things, and maybe you'll see a deer. And there's tons of turkeys out there and lots of squirrels, and it just seems like a really peaceful experience. And a lot of people are, including myself, are so caught up in today's work thing that they don't have that. And I think people should take the time to get out there. And you get to put some venison on the table, too.
All indications are that white-tailed deer are a very abundant resource in the United States, and their numbers have experienced incredible growth during the 20th century. We currently believe that the nation's deer population numbers about 26 million. In the early 1920s, it could have been as low as 350,000. This phenomenal growth has been due in part to aggressive management by state game directors who license hunters, prosecute poachers, and establish conditions under which deer hunting takes place. Gary Parsons, who is the chief of the Bureau of Wildlife of New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation, describes the rationale for the way his department issues deer hunting licenses.
So we try to take a management approach, which is by removing numbers of animals through a hunting season in New York, in these upstate areas, to achieve that population. For instance, in New York right now, we have approximately 650,000 deer prior to the deer season. In upstate this year, we expect to take approximately 150,000 of those. So after the deer season, which will end here in a few days, we will have about 500,000 deer left. Next June, we'll have someplace between 175 to 200,000 fawns added back, so we'll be at about 700,000 animals.
After meeting with everyone concerned about deer, farmers, orchardists, motorists, hunters, and people who enjoy wildlife but do not hunt, the non-consumptive users, Parsons determines what the deer population should be in a particular management area. Permits to take does or females are then issued in sufficient number to reduce deer population to the desired level. Without hunting, Parsons says major environmental destruction by an increasing deer population will result. Alan Rutberg, senior scientist for wildlife and habitat protection of the Humane Society of the U.S., an animal rights organization, does not think hunting is an appropriate management tool. He argues that management through hunting keeps the herd young, which produces increasing numbers.
What state game agencies call healthy really is a concept that is based on domesticated livestock rather than on wildlife. Typically, heavily hunted deer populations are young. They reproduce fast, and they die young. And that's not at all typical of a natural population of mammals. In a quote, natural population, what you would find would be high mortality very early in life, and then once an animal reaches adulthood, probably a pretty good long life expectancy, and reproduction, maybe slow reproduction over the course of that life. But that's not what hunting produces in a deer herd. Nobody really knows what happens if you don't hunt a deer population over time. No one lets it get to that level. The assumption is always that if you let a deer population go, they will increase and increase and increase, and then they will crash to some level with mass starvation and following, of course, a period of ecological destruction. And it's possible that that might happen in some areas, and it's possible that that wouldn't happen. But basically, the experiment hasn't been done, and like I say, it's not likely to because of the strong interest in hunting.
Moreover, Rutberg says we need a comprehensive approach to deer management that goes far beyond hunting.
We want to see management focused on solving specific problems and on managing deer, and again, managing people to allow deer and people to live together peacefully as much as possible. And that means looking at non-lethal alternatives when they're appropriate, and that includes things like fencing and repellents and engineering roads to keep them out of deer habitat and keep deer off them.
In the ranch country of Texas, deer management takes a different form. Jim Teer, director of the Wilder Wildlife Foundation outside of Corpus Christi, describes deer management as a profitable ranching activity.
And over the last 3 or 4 decades, there has become a commercial or a fee hunting system that is very important to the ranching community because people have to pay to hunt on private lands. And at the present time, even though cattle prices vary up and down, overall, the ranchers in this area, South Texas, from Austin South, really receive more income from the sale of hunting rights than they do from domestic livestock.
Looking forward, we see trends which indicate deer hunting license sales are going down as an increasingly urbanized population hunts less. We also see suburban areas overrun by deer. In those places, hunting is not an option because it endangers the general populace. State officials, independent researchers, and the Humane Society all agree we need to develop new techniques in these areas to strike the balance between people and deer. Research to develop deer contraceptives is one hope, but the solution is still a long way off. The white-tailed deer is an example of one renewable resource that challenges us with its abundance rather than its scarcity. I'm Peter Burley. Today, elements of the environmental movement can be found nearly everywhere in society. You can buy so-called green products or invest in environmentally friendly mutual funds. As Thomas Lally reports, environmentalism is now becoming a major force in religion.
Environmentalism has long been a political movement based on things like saving land from development or reducing pollution. But today, some theologians are saying that the environment has everything to do with religion. Virtually every religion now has some element of environmentalism in it. Safi El-Din Hamed is an environmental planning consultant with the World Bank and a scholar of Islamic law found in the Muslim holy book, the Quran. He says humanity is essentially just the tenant farmer on God's land.
Man was created. I'm saying man, of course, not in gender, but generically, man and woman were created for a purpose, to be Khalifa. Khalifa is an Arabic word which means steward on earth or trustee on earth. So the very basic mission of humankind is really to be the steward, the trustee on earth.
Let's do it on behalf of...
In behalf of God.
This concept is reiterated by many Jewish and Christian thinkers. But saying humans are responsible for keeping the garden is one thing. Figuring out how to do that is something else. Ishmael Schorsch is the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City. He calls Judaism a natural religion grounded in the rhythms of the planet. He says it teaches Jews to respect the environment by being disciplined.
I think we live in a society that maximizes economic opportunity and political freedom. I think what we need to cultivate in order to balance those opportunities is a kind of inner reserve that gets us not to do everything that we are permitted to do. This is where I think religion comes in. Religion reigns in our appetites. It reminds us that the most important things in life are matters of the spirit and not matters of wealth or material existence.
Schorsch and others emphasize that improving the environment will require individual transformations. They say enforcement from government can only go so far. James Nash is the executive director of the Church's Center for Theology and Public Policy and author of the book Loving Nature. He links the concept of Christian love to our responsibility to nature.
If God is love, that means that God loves all which God has created. That means that God loves not only human beings, but, scorpions, grizzly bears, and what have you. Well, that's significant in itself, but there's this complementary idea in Christian ethics that a Christian is to be faithful to God's affections and to be an image of God the lover. Consequently, we are to find ways to love what God loves. That implies that loving nature is an extension of the idea of loving our neighbors, because these other creatures on this planet are also God's beloved creatures.
Nash, Hamed, and Schorsch consider environmental decay a moral problem. To them, the excesses of modern living and the inequities between rich and poor are unacceptable. But while Christianity strongly condemns wealth, Judaism and Islam are more accepting of enjoying the fruits of one's labors. Nonetheless, Schorsch says our modern lifestyle has gone too far.
I think it is epitome of selfishness that I will consume and exploit whatever I possibly can in the few years that I walk the face of the earth. It is utterly indifferent to the generations to come, to the needs of my neighbors, and we simply do not have the absolute right to destroy that which has been given to us.
Theologians say religion can be the most valuable tool for environmentalists because it brings with it tradition and very often compliance. Safi Hamed points out that dating back to the 14th century, many Islamic countries had a hizbah, or an Office of Public Inspection, not unlike the modern Environmental Protection Agency. There were even hemas, or nature preserves. Today they're called national parks. Hamed says the merger of environmental concerns with religion signals the maturing of the environmental movement because religion engenders responsibility and wonder, things often missing from our modern lifestyle. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening in the lane? The holiday season is upon us. This is a time when Americans consume huge amounts of resources at an incredible rate. Can we keep this up forever? Probably not. So we've asked you how we can achieve a sustainable Christmas or Hanukkah. Shirley Weiner is a listener from Western Massachusetts. She says her family came to the understanding long ago that Christmas doesn't need to be overly extravagant.
Basically, tone Christmas down, starting with an understanding with your family that not everyone one knows or is related to needs a Christmas present, or at least not a present that costs a lot. And certainly your family members don't each need piles of presents. Draw names in your family so that each of you can afford one or two pretty nice gifts. give tickets to shows, concerts, plays, sports events. They don't need much wrapping. They also don't have to be thrown away later. Join forces with other family members and give the money for a trip or a really large gift that's been wished for. Don't give gifts that are not really needed or wanted. After all, the reduced number of gifts have been opened on Christmas Day. Just enjoy each other for the rest of the day, or hate each other, whatever. Happy holidays.
And David Goldbeck, who co-authored the book Choose to Reuse with his wife Nikki, has other gift ideas.
The used marketplace is an important place, and you know, nobody objects to getting beautiful used antiques, and there are things like used computers, and there's a lot of people today who would like to have a computer that can't afford them. They want to be able to get onto internet or whatever, and they say that there are 6 million used computers being thrown out every year. There's also rebuilt computers. You can buy factory rebuilt computers and actually get new computer warranties on them. Used sporting goods and musical instruments are great for starting people who may don't know exactly whether they're going to stay with that sport or stay with that that instrument, and get them started until the point in which maybe you want to buy really good equipment for them. And another area is buying gifts that are made from used material or salvage material or what normally would be waste material. There's some beautiful gift items that are basically new items that are being made, for example, rejected computer circuit boards, and they have a beautiful high-tech look to them, things like picture frames and jewelry.
A listener from Illinois suggests candles and paper bags half filled with sand as an alternative for outdoor electric lighting decorations. We're eager to hear some of your suggestions, so write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206, or you can email us at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. I'm Peter Burley. We all have places which are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's a place deep in the wilderness. David Winsinas is an author living in California, and his new book is entitled Sagebrush and Cappuccino, Confessions of an L.A. Naturalist. He presents a portrait of a windowscape in Los Angeles, where the place was important to him because of what flew by.
Somebody made a mistake. They assigned me to a top-floor corner office with two huge windows. It doesn't make sense. 9 years have passed since I had an office with real walls, let alone windows. Maybe the week I started this job, no one was vying for symbols of corporate power. As soon as I move in, I position my desk so that all day I face an enormous, uplifting, glorious sweep of sky. I can watch storm clouds drag across the horizon. I can track the slow arc of the sun. My corner office does not offer a million-dollar view. I gaze down on the red-tiled rooftops of West Los Angeles, broken occasionally by islands of treetops. On days when the smog clears, I can see the wooded hump of Palos Verdes Peninsula rising like a green whale above the vast cityscape. But I don't fixate on the landscape. Mainly I watch birds. Even here, in the middle of L.A., I see hundreds of them. Of course, most are what I call city birds, the tough guys of the avian world. Pigeons, sparrows, seagulls, crows, jays, mockingbirds. Pigeons seem unremarkable, except for their ubiquity. But gulls impress me with their graceful flight. Each is a Baryshnikov. It's the crows, however, that are a revelation. Every day, about an hour before the sun sets, one lights on the peak of the roof next door and caws. Or I should say honks. His beak parts, his long tongue waggles. Every exclamation practically knocks him from his perch. When the honker, as I call him, begins the performance, his fellow crows swing by. Riding the stiff afternoon breeze, they swoop and dive in the air outside my window. From my lookout, I don't just observe battle-scarred city birds. I spot many truly wild species. Once I made a positive ID on 5 rough-legged hawks flying just above the office buildings on Santa Monica Boulevard. In the fall, I often see migrating Canada geese. A few times, while sitting at my desk, I've even seen a falcon. I'm not sure what kind it was, for it was flying far out over the city, but I could distinguish the bird by its strong, rapid wing strokes. Compelled to confirm this sighting, I bring binoculars into the office. When I use them, I must be discreet. One problem with glass walls is that people can see in as easily as I can see out. So furtively, I peer over my computer monitor, sweeping the skies. I must take care. This assignment has given me windows, and I don't want to jeopardize such good fortune. Recently, a new manager walked into my room and asked scornfully, "How did you get this office?" I could see ambition flashing in his eyes, and I steel myself for the inevitable. A few weeks later, he announces a departmental reorganization. Naturally, it requires him to take occupancy of my little piece of the sky. So I pack my binoculars, fill a couple cardboard boxes, and say goodbye to the honker and his rowdy pals. Over the months, I have several occasions to visit the usurper in his new corner office. He has positioned the desk with his back to the windows, and as we talk, I look past him over the familiar red-tiled roofs. I try to catch a glimpse of the crows swooping, or the gulls, or maybe even the falcon. The career climber speaks to me of important business considerations, but I find it hard to pay attention. He and I are looking toward different horizons.
In our Earth calendar, we look at what is happening this week in the western end of the Amazon basin in Peru, where the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research operates the station. Roger Mustalish, president of the center, tells us that in this area of the world where it is always wet, the water level fluctuates tremendously, a seasonal variation of as much as 40 feet. Mustalish says that the water is now beginning its annual rise, which stimulates some interesting plant growth and produces incredible biodiversity.
There's a particular plant down in northeastern Peru called Camu Camu, and it's a tall shrub, maybe a small tree, about 10, 12 feet tall, and it has this rather large purple fruit, but just a single one of these fruits contain over 400 times the daily requirement for vitamin C, and it's a very important plant for the local people that live in the rainforest there. This plant is only found in an area of flooded forest, and so we were able to see quite clearly in satellite imaging all of the flood zones that exist along the major tributaries of the Amazon in this part of Peru, the Napo River, the Marañón, the Nanay, and you can clearly pick out this area of flooding, and that, of course, then indicates where the Camu Camu plant can be. Here's an example, then, of a plant that has specifically adapted to these kinds of flooding conditions. And we're just getting into the time of the year right now that this plant prefers the best because it gets fully inundated and a lot of nutrients that are carried in by the Amazon from the Andes further to the west are then deposited and fertilize this plant. In this quieter pools further into the forest, you'll start to see the development of these unbelievably large Amazon water lilies. These water lilies, for example, can be 8 feet in diameter, and they have a raised lip and edge. And there's a lot of stories about how the local indigenous people, especially the women, if they have young babies with them, will go down to these pools maybe to fish or to collect water or to wash clothes, and they'll use these huge Amazon water lilies as like playpens, and they'll put the babies inside, and these lilies are so big and so strong that they can support the weight of a small child.
As the waters continue to rise in the Amazon basin over the next couple of months, we'll revisit Roger Mustalish, who gives us a new comprehension of the concept of biodiversity. He describes an area with more species of plants in a few square miles than are found in all of North America. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 310. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Join us next week for The Environment Show.